Well, we often feature Ford Motor Company employees on the show because of their innovative work on behalf of sustainability. But never have we moved beyond the work milieu to what they may be doing in their personal lives, at least not until now. Russ and I are on site at the Detroit West Village home of Alessandra Carrion, a materials regulatory engineer for Ford, who embraces the sustainability ethos at work and at home. Alessandra, thank you for your hospitality.
Thank you.
Let's talk first, before we walk around your home, we're going to do a little bit of a tour here to see some of the things that you've been doing to make this a net zero home. But a little about your job at Ford. You're part of the sustainability team, I understand. But what is it that you do?
I'm a materials regulatory engineer, so I work on vehicle-related matters that deal with environmental rules. That means that I can help negotiate policy as it affects Ford products. We make sure that we're looking at green chemistry, making sure we're recycling materials. So it's a varied role that allows me to apply my passion for sustainability across the products we sell.
Well, as I mentioned in my open, we've been very impressed with the sustainability ethos at Ford. And we get the impression from talking to folks like you that it's not just a corporate mantra, but you folks are really living the sustainability ethic.
That's true. At Ford, we talk about a better world and building a better world. And so I'm very fortunate, I feel, to have a job that directly applies to building a better world. And then, just as you said, it's something that I can feel proud of when I go home and continue that kind of work.
Reading about some of your work that you've done at Ford, you've had some experience in terms of where precious metals come from and the whole supply chain. As you know better than I, a green supply chain can be a very complicated thing to verify. Talk to us a little bit about how Ford goes about that in general and how you went about that with the precious metals.
Sure. So before transitioning to my current materials regulatory engineering job, I worked with our global supply chain sustainability team. And that's where, as you said, I was looking over a group of metals called conflict minerals. So I worked with our conflict minerals team. And within supply chain sustainability, we also have a human rights and working conditions and an environment team. So through conflict minerals, we worked with our suppliers to conduct due diligence to make sure we weren't contributing to conflict in certain parts of the world.
By conflict, for our listeners, what do you mean by conflict?
So there is a rule called the Conflict Minerals Rule that publicly traded companies need to comply with, and it's essentially asking these companies to conduct due diligence, to do research along their supply chain, and the conflict really boils down to human rights violations, mostly in Central Africa.
Now, tracking these supply chain metals, as you mentioned, back to the source, I mean, you get the end product here, but I imagine there are many, many steps along the way. How does one go about tracking something from maybe Central Africa that comes out of the ground to Ford and making sure that every step along the way is an example of a sustainable production?
It is very difficult, admittedly. It's a challenge because companies like Ford, manufacturers, might be up to 10 tiers removed from the source of many of these minerals and metals. And what it takes is really a commitment and partnership with suppliers and their sub-suppliers. And it is helpful to have these regulatory structures in place that enable us to, cast a wide net. But again, it's a commitment of Ford to make sure that we're responsible how we source.
My guest is Alessandra Carrion. She's a materials regulatory engineer for Ford. Let's come back to the regulatory part of this now and the policy. A lot of EPA policy, a lot of pressure from EPA, frankly, over the past several years. How do you see that changing under the new administration, or do you see it changing at all?
That's probably an area that I would defer to my colleagues on. My work is mostly in materials regulation, so I'm looking over different regulatory schemes that might apply to substances of concern, chemicals that we use. So I know I have colleagues who are experts in sort of projecting that.
Well, some of these chemicals and materials, what happens if you find something that is of a concern? I mean, what is the protocol once you're alerted to the fact that there may be a problem?
So we have a lot of experts at Ford that look over this chemistry, that look over regulations as they relate to these materials. So there are many systems that you know we can use to ensure that we are using chemicals responsibly. So my job is specifically looking over, say, new regulations or understanding how our teams work together to make sure we're, again, doing the right thing.
Well, Alessandra, I mentioned that not only do you practice sustainability in the workplace with Ford, but also in your home here on Detroit's east side. We're going to take a little walking tour, but want to hear about some of the things you've done. And right after the break, we can take it from the top when you bought the house, and then show us some things. We'll take some pictures, and we'll put them on our blog.
Wonderful. Looking forward to it.
Well, Alessandra, before we start our tour of your home, your lovely home here, tell us a little bit about how you got to Detroit and why you decided to buy a house on the east side.
Sure. So I moved to Detroit about 5 years ago now from Seattle, Washington. I was working as an environmental engineer, and I was also very active in a lot of sustainability-related volunteer work. And as I was doing that work, I learned about this city along a river in the Midwest in Michigan, and without any family members, without anything else drawing me here, I was so taken by the energy of the city and all the good work of Detroiters who live here that I simply had to be here. So within less than a year, I moved from Seattle, and here I am.
Well, Seattle has a reputation for being one of the greenest cities, not only in America, but the world. And you were working in environmental engineering. I imagine there was a lot you learned in Seattle that you could apply here in Detroit.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And what the most fascinating thing to me is that while there was a lot I could learn in Seattle and apply in Detroit, the opposite is also true. I am learning so much in Detroit that I know, my friends and the organizations in Seattle can benefit from too. So you learn something wherever you go.
And so you came here, you worked for Ford, and you decided, let's look at some real estate, and then bought this house. How'd that happen?
So even before working for Ford, I was working as an AmeriCorps volunteer with Detroit Public Schools on sustainability initiatives with a local nonprofit. And so the work I was doing took me to the east side quite a bit. And as I was in different public schools on the east side, I simply fell in love with the housing stock, the architecture, the communities here, the people. And before you knew it, my husband, now husband, and I just decided to buy this home in West Village.
And not only decided to buy this home in West Village, but decided to work towards making it a net zero home. So where did you start?
So first of all, I should say this house is over 100 years old. It was built in 1912. And we were always committed to making sure that we made green choices, that we worked with our neighbors to ensure that, we were doing things that weren't perceived as niche or just for ourselves. We want to make sure that, the work we do is in community. And so I say that because as much as we have a lot of work that, we've done on the house itself, for us, it's also very important to give back where we can in our own neighborhood and participate in our neighborhood activities. So I always kind of frame it as, sure, we may be doing work in the home, but it's just as important to us to make sure we're doing work outside of that. And we can talk about that. But where we started, first of all, was in making materials choices, which is very coincidental with my current role. But the first commitment we made was to make sure that any sourcing decisions were based on prioritizing reuse before buying new. And so almost everything within the house we either bought used or secondhand or inherited from friends or family. So I would say that's one. And then that also boils down to how we applied finishes. So for example, the paint that you see on my walls is all zero VOC paint. The finish on the wooden floors is all a bio-based polyway. So we wanted to make sure where we could, we were making these responsible materials choices.
Okay, after the VOC paint and the floor finishings and lovely wood floors here, what about energy use?
So once we moved into the house, we wanted to make sure that our behaviors also reflected a more sustainable lifestyle, sustainable choices. So one of the first things we looked at was our energy system. So one, where does our energy come from? But then also, how do we use it? And soon we can take a look at the solar panels outside. But as far as energy use goes, we actually live here with other housemates. So there are at least five adults in the house at any time. And we make sure that the way we use electricity is prioritizing minimal use. So we only use what we need. We unplug appliances when they're not in use. We turn off the lights. And that really also benefits us from a cost savings perspective. So, we try to make sure that in talking about sustainability, we don't only talk about obviously the environmental and social benefits that matter very much to us, but also talk about the fact that this could help someone save money on their energy bill, on their water bill. So we have programmable thermostats that we use. We actually don't even have air conditioning. So in the summertime, we just benefit from the wonderful ventilation of cool air that comes in and then rises and along the way helps us stay cool with fans as well. And other heating tends to be electrical because we have solar panels. So we know that the energy that goes into our heat pump system is from the sun. So now we're looking at our programmable thermostat, and you can also see that our appliances in the kitchen are all Energy Star. So we made sure to do our research on appliances that save the most energy and installed those over conventional.
Now the heat pump system that you mentioned is really operates on geothermal principles, right?
There are geothermal heat pumps, but these are actually just electrical systems, and they have a sustainability benefit, again, because we know that the energy source for them is solar.
Now, you mentioned your solar panels, and we'll go out and look at those in a moment, but how much of your electricity are you generating from the solar panels, and are you selling any back to the grid?
So we are on a mission to become net zero. We're about 85% of the way there. So on average, in the summertime, we make more energy than we use. And so we actually, because of net metering, are paid for the excess. And then in the wintertime, when it's a little cloudier, and sometimes snowy, we generate less than we use, but that's compensated for the summer generation.
Okay, Alessandra, we're out looking at your solar pavilion, as you like to call it, and we're looking at some solar panels. Give us a little background on this.
Sure. So we installed 18 solar panels within about a year that we were living in the home. This is an almost 5-kilowatt system and does provide approximately 85% of our energy use. But one interesting thing I would like to point out here is that solar is possible even in historic districts. So the West Village neighborhood is a historic district, which means that when we decided to install solar panels, we actually had to go present to the commission. And the reason we have a solar pavilion at all is because we weren't able to put all 18 panels on the roof of our home. And so this was sort of our solution for that. It doubles as a carport, certainly. But it's something that I like to point out as a way to say solar, even in historic homes, no matter the kind of architecture, you can find a way to integrate it. It can really fit in with any lifestyle or aesthetic.
Now, a lot of folks who are considering solar, one of the questions that they ask is, in terms of your initial investment, return on investment, how long roughly do you think it's going to take for those panels to pay for themselves?
In our case, we took advantage of a great program that helps with financing called Michigan Saves. And we've calculated that it'll take maybe 10 years to pay back. But again, after that, we don't pay, we won't be paying a single cent for electricity, and the electricity we do have is green. So,
yeah, Michigan Saves, we featured them on this program two or three times. That is an excellent program that helps to subsidize the cost of these things.
Yep. And I will also say you can, we've been able to take advantage of it for systems like our insulation, which is also something we made sure we did as soon as we moved in to insulate against, extreme heat or cold.
Yeah, one other question on the solar. Are you actually storing some of that solar energy, or is it just being used as it's being generated?
It's being used as it's being generated, but another way to think of it is that the grid can serve as your battery. So all the energy goes back into the grid, and again, with net metering, we're able to get a payback sometimes.
We're taking a tour of the home of Alessandra Carrion in Detroit's West Village. Alessandra works for the Ford Motor Company, and she lives the sustainability ethos at home as well. Alessandra, we've talked about a lot of things. How about recycling and composting?
Sure. So we have, as one of our priorities, to minimize the waste we generate. We do that first by trying to buy less, certainly. But when we do have waste, we actually put out more recycling on the curb than trash. And again, this is for about 5 adults. And so on average, our frequency of putting out our trash bin is maybe once a month, whereas our recycling bin is out there, you know, every 2 weeks. But that handles non-organic waste. For any organic waste, the same principle applies. First, we try to make sure we aren't wasting any food. So whatever we have in the fridge, we consume to the extent that we can. But when we do have organics waste, we compost it. So again, we're very fortunate to have a neighborhood community garden, and so that helps us with composting. But there are a lot of different programs, and I know a lot of different urban farms and gardens around the city where if you are interested in composting, you could probably talk to your local garden, and there might be a way for you to do that for those interested.
Now, what do we have right here in front of us? We have a recycled bathtub and a toilet. And what's going on there? Is that composting?
Nope. What you can't see are potato leaves that are covered by some soil, and they'll be coming up again soon. Probably some slightly neglected onions somewhere. They're in here though. But we actually, when we renovated the house, we made sure that we found a home for everything that, you know, any construction waste that we had. So while we don't always use our planters out here, the bathtub and the toilet, ceramic toilet bowl are in fact planters. While we don't use them all the time, this is always a space for people to plant. And like I said, I've only got potatoes and onions going on right now. But the other thing I do want to point out in the backyard is what's hiding behind what are typically perceived as weeds are a bunch of native plants in a rain garden. So there's actually a depression here that you can't really see. And all of our downspouts on the backside of the home route to this rain garden. And the idea with the rain garden and green infrastructure in general is that we're trying to manage our stormwater on site before it goes into the storm drain and overburdens our combined sewer overflow system. So in the past few years, we've had a lot of proliferation of the native plants. Sure, there are some plants that we might identify as weeds, but again, that's very relative to how do you want to control the water that runs off of your property, off of hardscape, or off of the roof. And this does a wonderful job on rainy days. You'll see that the water just sort of slowly infiltrates back, and we also have rain barrels to catch any excess water from surfaces that aren't connected to a rain garden.
So really, I mean, it's stormwater management that's such a big deal, not only in Detroit, but all over the United States. And it looks like, are you able to manage virtually all of it with the rain garden?
Actually, most of it, yes. Certainly, there's rain that falls off other parts of the backyard or even the front yard. But a big chunk of the runoff from our roof actually goes straight to the rain garden.
Alessandra, you mentioned a commitment to not just your home, but a community sustainability ethic. Talk to us a little bit about the organization. I think you helped found it in West Village. And a couple of take-home messages for our listeners.
Thanks. Yeah. So I and many other dedicated, committed volunteers from the neighborhood helped found a sustainability committee through our neighborhood association. And the work of that sustainability committee, which is an entirely volunteer-led effort, actually resulted in West Village being designated one of the city's first two eco districts, along with Hope Village around Focus Hope. And what it means to be an eco district really is just that we have a plan developed by our own community to develop in a way that is environmentally, socially just and responsible. And that means that we are including or soliciting input from all of our neighbors, residents, or business owners to make sure that as West Village changes and evolves over time, that sustainability is at the forefront of that. So examples of that are, you know, in something like sharing best practices on leading a greener lifestyle, but then also working on projects in the neighborhood that promote solar lighting or promote green infrastructure, We actually have a Green Alley project that we'll be doing here in the neighborhood, again, to help manage stormwater, which is something that, as you said, is very important in the region. And this is something that not only through the Sustainability Committee, but, you know, the neighborhood as a whole, we prioritize, which is making sure that we engage our neighbors in building, like we say at Ford, a better world together.
And those take-home messages for our listeners in terms of what you've learned, Alessandra, from your work not only at Ford, but also with your home.
I would say the first thing is to consider what is within your means or desire to change. Sometimes people don't realize that really simple things like fixing water leaks or turning off the light have a really big impact. But beyond that, I would also say listening to your community members, listening to your neighbors. There are sometimes very simple projects too within the neighborhood that can be completed together. So this is really not each for herself kind of initiative. This is going to be as successful as you can learn from each other, learn from great organizations within your city. If you are in a neighborhood and want to start a sustainability committee, that helps too. But it's a matter of reflecting on, you know, maybe things that you might be able to change, and then working with others to have a bigger impact.
Well, it's been a delightful tour with Alessandra Carrion. We certainly appreciate being invited into your home to see all of the things that you're doing for a more sustainable planet. In her day job, she's a materials regulatory engineer for Ford. Alessandra, a pleasure meeting you. And again, thanks for your hospitality.
Thank you so much for being here with me today.